You're listening to Louisiana Insider, a superlative guide to a great state's destinations, hosted by Errol Labor, executive editor of Louisiana Life magazine.
It's our Louisiana song. It's our favorite melody. It's our Louisiana song. Hearing it echo through the cypress tree.
You know, I say this every week, you know, we have a really interesting show, and we usually do, but this is a really, really interesting show. Listen to this, it has an interesting topic. With me is Dennis Waltering, who those of you in the New Orleans area may remember as being the anchor for many years for WBL Channel 4 News. He left for a while and then came back, and very good reporter, very competent, and also has that news anchor voice, too. I mean, you know you're talking to an anchor. I feel almost embarrassed by being in the same room with you in your voice. But he's, I guess, in semi-retirement now and does some independent producing and directing in documentaries. And he had one that premiered January 17th on WYS Channel 12. Ethel mentioned it streamed. You can go to the Channel 12 website at any time and look at it. I'm sure there'll be some reruns of it too. What it is he looked at, it's called Louisiana Inventors and Innovators. And it's a fascinating list of a few people that I want to talk about. They're in no particular order, except for the last one. I want to keep last because it's a story of a woman that is just so fascinating. I wanted to make this like the grand finale. You know, it's like when you went to the circus and you had the person being shot out of a cannon kind of thing. You know, you save your biggest act for last. But anyway, these are all fascinating people. So let's start off with a guy that a lot of people will remember from TV commercials and not quite sure what was so significant about him, but it's quite a story. And this is David Orrick.
Yeah. I was lucky enough to interview him just 2 months before he died, between the Christmas and New Year's in 2022. And he was 99. And his story is just incredible. First of all, he loved flying. And he got an early start learning to fly when he was like 18 or 19 years old. They had a program to teach young people how to fly airplanes. And what they wanted to do, the United States wanted to do this, was to fly supplies to Britain to help the British in their war against Germany. But they didn't want the U.S. military involved, because they didn't want to get the U.S. involved in that war at that time. And so he learned to fly, but he never had an opportunity to fly to Britain with the supplies because World War II broke out. The Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, and he wanted to get into the action as soon as he could. He knew how to fly at that point, but they had more openings for navigators than pilots. So he went in as a navigator, and he flew a B-29 bomber as a navigator from Saipan to Tokyo and to Japan, and went on bombing missions. He said he had some terrifying moments, but he said he was lucky because he came home. And David Orrick was very emotional and about this, the war effort, and about those who died, those who gave up everything. And the World War II Museum interviewed him several times, and some of their clips are in the documentary. After he got out of the war, he could have gone to college on the GI Bill, but he wanted to get married, he wanted to have kids. He went to work for RCA and under General David Sarnoff, who ran RCA at that time. And General Sarnoff founded NBC. And Sarnoff was his first wife's uncle. And David Orrick said he never got a master's degree, but he studied at the feet of the master. He said he was like a sponge, soaking up everything this guy taught him. And he learned how to be a businessman, a salesman, and a good marketing man. And marketing is what he excelled at eventually. When he was 40 years old, he left RCA, he wanted to go out on his own. He sold Whirlpool vacuums for a while, and then he started his own company. He redesigned the vacuum to make it lighter weight, but still powerful. And he named it after himself, he said, because he couldn't think of another name. And then it became a challenge. His wife, Jan, told me about this, is that people thought it was so lightweight that it was like a toy. It couldn't be powerful. It couldn't be durable. So he had to go around and sell this idea that it was, yeah, it was lightweight, but it was also powerful. And that became the idea for his commercials, which, you know, as if you remember the commercials, I guess in the 70s and 80s, we last saw them, but they were often very funny. I mean, one of my favorites was him dressed as a cowboy, and he picks up a 16-pound bowling ball with the hose of a vacuum, and then he drops it, and he blows on the end of the hose. Like that. His vacuum cleaners were powerful. So he eventually got the idea across that they were powerful, and the cleaning crews in hotels loved them because they didn't have to lug around these huge, heavy vacuums anymore. They had a lightweight vacuum that was powerful. And so he was very successful, but he was a marketing man. And Jan Orrick told me the story, how he would go into colleges. So he never got a college education, but I think he lectured at more than 60 colleges because the college administrators wanted their students to learn from his success. And Jan said that he went in with two watches. One was like a $45 watch and the other was the Rolex. And he would say to the students, "What's the difference?" "Marketing." And that was his big belief. And he was very successful at marketing. I mean, he became a household name. And he sold vacuum cleaners around the world. 50,000 hotels at one point were using Orrick vacuums around the world.
Yeah, I was going to say he became a household name, but he also became the name of the his vacuum cleaner, his name too.
Exactly,
you know,
right.
He all this time to think about it, when I see his commercials, I was thinking, this is some local guy who's selling vacuum cleaners. And I never realized the extent of the story behind him.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that was part of the charm, is that he related to everyone as sort of, you know, a down-home kind of guy, almost a next-door neighbor. He was very comfortable on television. He was very, very engaging. He was a charming guy.
Now, where were the vacuum cleaners manufactured?
Well, some of them were manufactured on the Gulf Coast in Mississippi, but he also had manufacturing plants in other parts of the world.
Okay.
So, I mean, he made and sold vacuum cleaners, he said, around the world.
But it was his company that made the vacuum cleaners.
Yes, yes.
It's not like he was buying them from Kmart and changing the labeling. I mean, it's his vacuum cleaner.
No. What happened with Whirlpool, he started working for Whirlpool, and then the chairman of Sears, which was also selling Whirlpool vacuum cleaners, regarded him as a competitive threat because the Orrick was having so much success selling those vacuums. So the chairman of Sears, who was on the board of Whirlpool, said, "Get rid of him." And they got rid of him. So that's why he started his own company.
Wow. So what a fascinating story. Okay, somebody else in the list. Next thing on the list is J.M. LaPierre.
J.M. LaPierre. This guy was an incredible inventor. His father told him when he was in his teens, he said, "If you want to make a lot of money, invent a way to peel shrimp, to peel the shell off of shrimp." And so he and his uncle worked on this for a couple of years, and he discovered that if he wore a rubber boot, and if he went into the his father had a shrimp packing plant, if he went in there and sort of nudged the shrimp on the edge of his boot, he could squeeze the shell off. And he went home and tried it out on his mother's wringer. Remember those old-fashioned washing machines with the wringer above the load of wash? And he tried it on that, and he discovered he could indeed squeeze the shell off of the shrimp without damaging the meat. And so he and his uncle worked on this for a couple of years and eventually found a way to peel shrimp. This was a revolutionary thing that really caused the industry to explode. I mean, because before that it was, people were peeling shrimp by hand, and sometimes smaller shrimp were so difficult to peel that would sometimes just toss them away. And after he discovered that, after he came up with this way to peel shrimp, people in Scandinavia and Alaska and Iceland wanted to see if the invention would work on shrimp there. And shrimp there are much smaller, tinier, with not heavy shells like here on the Gulf Coast, very thin shells. So he took his machine up there to do a demonstration, and the machine ate up the shrimp. So he spent a couple more years figuring out how to peel those shrimp. And eventually he did that. And his son, one of his sons, Jay, said that basically created a shrimp industry in those areas. They didn't really have an industry there before. That was sort of very boutique. Someone said, okay, you figured out a way to peel shrimp, but you'll never figure out a way to devein shrimp. So he set about figuring that out, and he did figure out a way to devein shrimp. This guy was constantly inventing. His daughter, Monique McCleskey, has an archive of many of his things. Another thing he invented was what they called the LaPierre stair. You know, to someone climbing up a ladder on a ship and with tools and having difficulty getting up the ladder. And so he came up with a way that instead of having a rung that, you know, you step on one after another, he came up with alternate rungs, you know, alternate steps, the way you would walk, the way you actually walk. And he tried it out with, he put powder on the floor and walked up a set of stairs. And he said, your right foot steps on every other step. Your left foot steps on every other step. So we don't need the other half of the step on those, you know, when you step on the right side, you don't need the left side, for example. And he came up with a LaPierre stair he was marketing. Then he came up with, when they were moving the shrimp into the peeler, they had an old conveyor belt, metal conveyor belt. And it wasn't very hygienic because it would get all sort of crusty with the salt water and that sort of thing. So he thought, what about a plastic conveyor belt? People around him said that can't be done. Well, he came up with a plastic conveyor belt. When Jay, his son Jay, joined the company in the 70s, he said his father had so many different businesses based on inventions that the company was losing money because he was the only one who believed in them and other people didn't even know what they were. And he suggested selling the conveyor belt business. And he said, marketing people told him there's no market for this. You know, it's a dead end. You're wasting your time. And his father said, that's like telling me there's no gravity. They're crazy. Today, that conveyor belt business, Intralox business, is the most profitable business of their four divisions of Latrim. LaPierre's company became known as Latrim. Latrim is JM's middle name, Marshall, spelled backwards. And the conveyor belt business is now the most profitable. In 2022, the worldwide company made $1.1 billion in revenue based on his inventions. He's an incredible guy.
Now, that machine that they put the shrimp in, what did they do? Like squeeze the tip of the shrimp?
It has rollers on it, and it squeezes it again and again and again, not once, but again and again and again. One of his sons was saying that it takes off just a little bit of the shell each time until the shell is fully removed.
Okay, but it doesn't crush the shrimp. So
it doesn't damage the meat, no. Yeah.
And shrimp is like all over the world. I would think it must be maybe the most plentiful eaten seafood there is.
Yeah. And once he came up with that invention, you know, one of the things that happened, you know, the invention was very valuable when he first, because they had a copyright, they had a trademark. What do you call it? A trademark. They had the license for it. No one else could do it. But once that ran out, then the profits, you know, he had to reduce the prices. And that's when his son Jay joined the company. And that's when they were having trouble. They were having financial difficulties.
Right. Reminds me a little bit of peeling the crawfish, you know, take off the head and then pitch the tail and the meat pops out, you know, so.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly a very similar concept. Absolutely.
Okay. This next person, full disclosure here, I'm not related to him, but I wish I was. This would be Alden J. Doc Laborde.
Yeah.
What an influence he had. So tell us about him.
Well, Alden J. Doc Laborde grew up in central west Louisiana. And
I think he was from Avoyelles Parish, I believe, like around Marksville or something. It doesn't matter. In the middle of the state.
Yeah, I forget what it is. But he went to freshman year to LSU when tuition was $100 a semester. He felt his family couldn't afford to send him because they had two other sons. So he found his way into the U.S. Naval Academy and got a free education got a degree as a marine engineering degree, and wound up being in the Navy. He was a commander of a couple of vessels in the Navy. After the Navy, he came home, had to find work. First got work at just hauling cable, and then he got a working on an offshore drilling rig with an oil company. And he found that this oil company was having trouble with the offshore production, because what they were doing, he said, these guys were all from Texas and Oklahoma, and they were drilling in the water offshore the way they drilled on land. So they would build a rig, and if they hit a dry hole, they would have to take the rig apart and go to the next location, build it again. And, you know, that whole process was just time consuming, wasteful. And, you know, he thought there has to be a better way. So he said, why can't we have a movable, reusable rig? And he and a friend came up, another fellow engineer came up with this idea of a submersible oil rig. Basically, it's a barge on the bottom with these tall, hollow steel legs that go up to a platform, and you float it to a location, and then you flood the hull on the bottom, the barge on the bottom, with water. It sinks to the sea floor, and then you wait for it to sort of settle in, and then you start drilling from the platform above. This was, you know, a revolutionary concept, and he was the first one to do that. And it cost $2 million to build this rig. Shell Oil was the first one to agree to use it. And he was very worried, because when they first settled into the seafloor, he saw the rig kind of rocking, pitching back and forth, and he was afraid it wouldn't work. And they had a contract with Shell that said that Shell would pay $6,000 a day if it worked, or nothing at all if it didn't work. So he was afraid it wasn't going to work. But after a day or so, everything settled in, it worked, and Shell said, build us some more. That became Otico, Ocean Drilling and Exploration Company. That became a worldwide company with rigs around the world. He said that they built semi-submersible rigs that floated and were anchored with mooring lines. And he had rigs all over the world, including the North Sea. And in fact, he said they basically opened the North Sea. Their rigs were the first in the North Sea. And then after he had the first oil rig, the first one, which called Mr. Charlie, he discovered that he had a boat, an old Navy boat, to take supplies out to the rig. But the supply boat wasn't good enough, because it had an area for cargo in the front, area for cargo in the back, but it wasn't enough. It wasn't enough space. So he designed a different boat with a big cargo area in the back. And he built 10 of those boats to service all the rigs in the area. And that company eventually became Tidewater Marine. His brother took over that company. That became a worldwide company servicing oil rigs all around the world. Then later on, he and a friend, he retired from Otico after a while. They sold Otico and he retired. He with a friend started another company, which became Gulf Island Fabrication. Gulf Island Fabrication made marine vessels, made oil rigs, and was making foundations, is now making foundations for offshore wind turbines. And all three of these companies became publicly traded companies. I mean, this guy was, I mean, these people were so inspiring, you know, that they just persisted with their ideas until they finally came to pass.
I wonder if the guys on the rigs ever wouldn't caught some shrimp and they got one of those machines to peel them. I don't know. As I mentioned, I'm probably not related to them. I guess maybe distantly I am. I do know some of his offspring, and they're a great family. I mean, they're really good people, and they do a lot.
His son Jack was Rex 1 year.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, if I may, let me tell you the story. I think I mentioned to you once. Jack Laborde told me that when he found out he was going to be raptured, he told his wife, and then he realized he should go tell his dad, okay? And so he went one day, he says, "Dad, I think I got something to tell you." "What's that, son?" He says, "I'm going to be reps this coming year." And he says, "You know, Jack, I've always thought that God has kept me alive this long for something special. I hope this isn't it." Anyway, we've got, all right.
Skipped over one, which is Ruth Fertel.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, Ruth Fertel.
Yeah. So Ruth Fertel was, she was a single divorced mother of two children, and she was a lab technician at Tulane University, not making really enough money to, she wanted to send her sons to college and thought she wouldn't be able to afford to do that. So her house was paid off, and she saw an ad for a steakhouse for sale on Broad Street, $18,000. The owner was retiring. So her son Randy said she was a gambler, and she basically wagered her house for a dream. She had hardly any experience in the restaurant business. Her brother Sig owned a restaurant in Port Sulphur, and sometimes she worked there, but she didn't really have any extensive experience. So she buys this steakhouse, which was Chris Steakhouse on Broad Street, and she winds up, she has to cut hacksaw 30-pound loins into steak. She learns how to mix drinks. She learns how to cook. She learns how to waitress. She learns how to buy supplies and take care of inventory. She has to learn everything. Just several months after she bought the restaurant, Hurricane Betsy hit and, you know, wiped out the area. I mean, electricity was out, you know, everything was out, but there were crews working to get things back in place, to fix the electricity, to fix the houses, fix the streets, all that stuff. So once she got her electricity back, got her business back open, she said the Archbishop said you could eat meat on Fridays, because special dispensation, because after Hurricane Betsy, people needed help. They couldn't, you know, buy special food. So she opened her restaurant on a Friday, and these workers who were on unlimited expense accounts came into a restaurant and started building up her business. She said that disaster turned out to be a good thing for her in the long run.
Yeah.
And she eventually, this $18,000 steakhouse, eventually she sold franchises, and she built a fine dining business with more than 140 restaurants worldwide. 34 years after she bought an $18,000 steakhouse, she sold it for $160 million.
And didn't she create the concept of the sizzling steak?
Yes, yes, that's exactly right. So, and her friend Lana Duke, who was doing her advertising early on, sort of promoted that idea. And she told Ruth that she should put the plate in the boiler before they put the steak on and the butter to get the extra sizzle. And one of the first ads says, "The steak that speaks for itself," one of the ads on TV, and you could hear the sizzle. You know?
I remember in the early days of the Superdome, they had this big screen that would drop down over the center. It was very loud, and they had a lot of those commercials. And all of a sudden, you're sitting there, and then there's this loud sizzle that just comes off the set. It was, you know, to the point of being annoying, but boy, I got the message across. She also faced an unusual naming situation. Okay, yes. It was Chris Steakhouse.
Yes.
I think she wanted to call it Ruth Steakhouse, but I don't know what the Chris people said. No, you can't do that. Or
Yeah, well, what happened was Chris Steakhouse, there was a fire in the Chris Steakhouse, and it was going to be out for several weeks, maybe a couple months. And she happened to have at that point a catering hall down the street, 7-Eleven Broad. And so she hired a contractor who transformed that into a restaurant in the space of just a week. And she couldn't name it Chris, because Chris could only be used on the original restaurant. So she named it Ruth's Chris Steakhouse. And that's how it became Ruth's Chris.
Which was a very unusual way of naming a restaurant. But now we see it Uptown
on Alley, also.
What?
Pascal's Manali.
Pascal's Manali, yeah. So that was the second of that genre of names. She has, I think it's a grandson named Ryan Fertel, who's a very talented writer. We had him on this podcast one time. He'd written a fascinating book about pelicans. And And her son is doing a lot of creative research too. But yeah, she was really important. And of course, Ruth's Chris became the big political hangout.
Yes.
You know, it was known for where the politicians would go.
Exactly right. In fact, one of the ads, one of the TV ads that her friend Lana Duke made, sort of tried to portray Ruth's Chris as a very provocative place. And it said something to the effect that a place where politicians make deals over drinks and under the table, and shows someone getting some cash under the table.
But you know, after Katrina, okay, she sold the restaurants, what it said, Orlando Company.
Yes.
It was coming to Florida. And they closed the one in New Orleans on Broad Street for a while. And that really paid me off. I mean, I thought, here it is, it's the definitive New Orleans restaurant.
Yeah, I think that was after Katrina they did that. Yeah.
Yeah,
that was a shame, I thought. That was a shame.
And so, I mean, there's Ruth's Chris back in New Orleans, but I think it's via a franchise thing through their company in Orlando, but it's the same, you know, the same sort of steakhouse. So it really made New Orleans just famous. I mean, New Orleans was not the kind of town you think about for steaks before that, you know. And I think Ruth's Chris did a lot to establish that.
Yeah.
Very interesting. All right. Now let's bring this to Jerome Goldman.
Okay. Jerome Goldman was another marine engineer, and he also designed oil rigs. He designed the first jackup oil rig, and he also designed submersible and semi-submersible rigs. When he was a child, his grandson was telling me that when he was a child, and we have pictures of his artwork in the show, when he was a child, he was designing ships, you know, those tall ships. And when he was just like 8 or 9 years old, he had these meticulous drawings. It was almost like he knew what he was going to do when he grew up. And so he designed these oil rigs, and he designed a ship oil rig, a boat that had a rig on it, and that you could float to a location and drill a rig, drill a well. But he also had inventive designs for ships. And Merritt Lane of Canal Barge tells the story of how in the old days on freighters, if you wanted to ship something across the ocean, you would have to find space on a whole ship. You'd have to get space on a whole ship or find a ship that would let you put some of your cargo on the ship with other cargo. And then the ship would go to the place where it's headed, the destination, and wait in line for a berth at the harbor. And then the longshoreman had to load it or unload it. He said this was a time-consuming process, and the ships were sometimes at the harbor for several days before they could unload or load their cargo. So Goldman came up with this idea called LASH, lighter aboard ship. And a lighter is a British term for a small barge. And these LASH ships had a crane that could lift the lighter onto the ship and lift it off when it got to the destination. And they could have, each lighter could have cargo for a different destination. So for example, a ship could pull into New Orleans and they'd offload whichever lighters were meant for New Orleans, then wouldn't have to wait for a berth at the dock, wouldn't need longshoremen, anything like that. The LASH could go in and, you know, they could unload the LASH. Then the ship could go to another destination, maybe, you know, upriver, maybe Baton Rouge, and unload more lighters. So it was a much more efficient way to ship cargo. And eventually, Merritt Lane said, this was replaced by container ships, you know, those containers that they have on the ships that they offload onto trucks.
And that changed the industry entirely too, huh?
Containers. Yeah. Yeah. So that for 25 years, the LASH was very popular, but then container ships took over. He also invented below deck cargo ships. And that's where they put all of the cargo in the hull. And before that, they would stack it up on top of the deck, and sometimes they would lose their cargo and stuff like that. So he had this other idea, and this became a worldwide phenomenon. This is what people use now. He also left his designs on New Orleans. He designed the Chevron building, and he designed One River Place. So he really left his mark on the city.
Yeah. And anywhere you travel around the world, if you go near the river, you see the container ships and the container cargoes, you know.
Exactly right.
And now there are some companies that actually develop the containers as like condos in places to stay, you know. So there's a new market for the containers. All right. So this is our final one on this list. This is the one I said at the beginning I wanted to save to me. The most these are all fascinating, but I really want to emphasize this one. So this is Sarah Breedlove.
Sarah Breedlove was her original name, but then she became later known as Madam C.J. Walker.
Okay. So everybody, get the cat out the room, raise your volume, and listen to this story. This is a fascinating
Yeah, she is really phenomenal. I mean, she was born in the cabin where her family had been enslaved in Delta, Louisiana. She was born 2 days before Christmas, 1867, 2 years after the Civil War ended. And when she was 7 years old, her parents had died. She moved in with a sister across the river in Vicksburg, Mississippi. Later years, she said that her brother-in-law, her sister's husband, was so abusive that she left the home and got married when she was 14 so she could have a home of her own. When she was 17, she had a child, a daughter named Lelia. And then when she was 20, her husband died. So here she is. And this was, you know, this was in the Jim Crow era when there was horrible discrimination. There were a lot of lynchings and stuff like that. She and her daughter moved to St. Louis, where four of her older brothers were barbers. And she worked as a washerwoman, washing people's clothes on hand boards. And she eventually got married to a guy, and it didn't last very long because he was running around on her. He was drinking a lot. And so she left him. And at around that point, she felt her hair was falling out. Now, this was like the mid to late 1800s. And in those days, there was no running water. So people would take a bath maybe once a week at best, sometimes once every few weeks, once a month. And African-American women have that kinky hair. And if it's not really clean, it can become infected. And she had infections and scalp ailments. And I interviewed her great-great-granddaughter who lives in Washington, D.C., who told me this story. And she said that really part of the problem with her hair falling out was a matter of hygiene and stress. And then she found a formula that some woman was selling called a hair grower. So she bought some of that hair grower, and she found that her hair was coming back, growing back. And her great-great-granddaughter says part of that was that she was cleaning it more regularly, and her hair was coming back. To get away from her husband, she moved to Denver, and she took some of the hair grower. She started selling this hair grower from this other woman was making. And she took a bunch of that stuff with her to Denver. A pharmacy there, the owner of a pharmacy there, looked at that hair grower and analyzed it and said, you know what, this is not a unique formula. He said, you can mix your own version of this formula and sell your own product. So that's what she did. So she started selling her own product. And then a man she had been seeing in St. Louis moved to Denver, and eventually they got married. His name was Charles Joseph Walker, C.J. Walker. So first, when she was selling her product, and she would put her own image on her product, on the hair grower she was selling. And first it was Mrs. C.J. Walker, and eventually she started calling herself Madam C.J. Walker. And what she did was she would go and have sales agents. She would hire sales agents. And it was sort of an Amway kind of a situation where everyone up the line would make a little bit of what the people they brought into the business was selling. So she was hiring sales agents all over the place. She and her husband were hiring sales agents, going around training them to sell this product. Eventually, they moved to Pittsburgh, and they went around the country hiring sales agents to sell this product. Eventually, they wound up in Indianapolis, and she started making, you know, a lot of money at that time. I mean, male laborers were making $40 to $60 a month when she was making $300 a month. She built a factory. She built a home in Indianapolis, and they wanted to build a new YMCA, and she donated $1,000 to that YMCA. And I forget now what that was. That would be like $13,000 or $23,000 in today's money. It would be $23,000 in today's money, which is just astonishing. And everyone was impressed that a Black woman could do this. And they didn't quite believe that she could do it, but she paid the money. A lot of the people who said they'd donate money to this project never did donate money, but she made good on her pledge. She also became friendly with the owner of a publisher of a Black newspaper, a national Black newspaper, and advertised her stuff through his newspaper. And she was an amazing woman. She went from selling the product. She brought her daughter into New York City. Her daughter built her daughter bought a building and made a home there, and also had a business downstairs where they trained women to learn how to sell the product and to use it on women's hair. Eventually, this woman, Madam C.J. Walker, built a mansion in Irvington, New York, on the Hudson River, near the John D. Rockefeller Estate. And it was she paid $250,000 to build a mansion. In today's money, that would be $6,396,000. Mm-hmm. People could not believe it. She also became involved in civil rights, because there was a lot of lynching and major discrimination, Jim Crow era discrimination against Black people. And so she became involved with the NAACP and anti-lynching campaigns. The War Department investigated her and anti-lynching activist Ida B. Wells, and called them both subversive Negroes. And her great-great-granddaughter laughed at that and said, well, she was subversive in the interest of civil rights. She was working for civil rights. So she was constantly traveling. I mean, even after she got to even from Indianapolis and New York, she was traveling across the country, always traveling, hiring sales agents. At one point, she went back to Delta, Louisiana, to the place where she was born, where her parents had been enslaved, and met with the daughter of the family, one of the daughters of the family that had owned her family. And they, according to her great-great-granddaughter, had a cordial relationship. And in fact, the daughter of the Birney family, which had enslaved her family, visited her in New York at one point. Just an interesting sidelight to her life.
Was there like one person in particular that was her inspiration or her guide? I mean, she had to have some kind of skill at raising money and building businesses.
Well, the business aspect, I think, developed a little bit from Annie Turnbow Malone, who was the woman who owned the original hair grower that she started using and selling. And Annie Turnbow Malone was also hiring sales agents to do this. So she sort of copied what Annie Turnbow Malone was doing, but she had much more success with it and was much more, she was constantly working, you know, constantly traveling, hiring agents and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Was she well-known, or would she become well-known in Louisiana, where people...
She was well-known in the Black community, and her business, by the way, it was an international business. I mean, she traveled to Cuba, Haiti, Costa Rica. She had sales agents all over the Americas, Central America, and even South America.
Now, does any form of the business still exist?
It does still exist. I don't think it's quite as... It's not as profitable or as... as
impact. There's probably a lot of competition out there in the
market. And one other thing, Errol, I mean, I think people would think, in fact, I thought this, that when I heard about this hair grower, that what it really was a hair straightener, because Black women in those days wanted to straighten their hair. And her great-great-granddaughter said that actually the hair grower did not straighten hair. Madam C.J. Walker objected when a newspaper reporter said that she had a product that straightened hair. She said, I only promise to make hair grow. I don't straighten hair. But her great-great-granddaughter says the hair grower was meant to make hair grow. But she also worked with hot irons, which were used to straighten hair. So she was straightening hair with hot iron combs.
Okay. Well, we're talking to Dennis Waltering, who has a documentary, Louisiana Investors and Innovators. And Dennis, before we finish, I just want to ask you, talking to these people, what is it about them? Did you find any kind of common denominator that they had which made them what they are?
Well, I think I think there was a common denominator, and it was that they would have an idea or they have a mission, that something that they wanted to do, and they never gave up on it. They just persisted until they made it happen. I mean, they knew where they wanted to go, and they were not diverted from that course. Doc Labord, for example, I mean, he had this idea for an offshore submersible oil rig, and no one believed in it. People didn't believe in it. This one other engineer kind of thought it was a good idea, but other people, companies, he tried to sell it to Shell, tried to sell all these oil companies along the Gulf Coast. None of them were interested. Finally, he found this company in Arkansas, which was a little company then at that time, Murphy Oil, and they didn't know anything about offshore oil drilling or anything like that, but they wanted to get into the business. So they were the ones who gave him initial financing that helped him build the $2 billion he needed to build that first submersible oil rig. But every one of these people was very persistent. Same with like David Orrick. People thought his vacuum was probably not very powerful because it was so light. Well, he made the marketing campaign that said lightweight and powerful. Then another thing that with Orrick was that his vacuums were more expensive than a lot of other brands. And he said that was never a concern of his, because he said it doesn't matter what something costs. What matters is whether people want it or not, if they have a desire to own it, to use it. He said what you have to do is build that desire for people to want it, and they would buy it. And he was right.
Didn't he open a security center in downtown
Yes,
New
yes,
Orleans? He bought
yes.
it was an old stock market building or something.
I think it might have been a treasury building or something like that.
Okay.
But yes, and his family still owns that. Yeah, it's a security center. And then after he sold the vacuum business, he acquired a candle making business that he sold online. And so he never stopped working. But also the thing about David Orrick, he loved flying. And you may know that he flew small planes, and he had a collection of vintage small planes. And he said in this conversation I had with him 2 months before he died, he said, "If I ever come into this life again, I hope it's in the flying business."
Wow.
Was a remarkable man.
Now, other documentaries that you've done, you did something on Dr. Ochsner
Yes, Dr.
and
John.
on Blaine Kern.
Yeah.
And I've seen them both. They were all fascinating. You really do a good job of getting into these people's lives. Anybody else on your radar for future documentaries?
Not yet, but I really enjoy doing this. I just like telling the stories. I learn a lot going along the way as well.
That's the classic of storytelling. You find an interesting person. There's always some kind of conflict in there, and the resolution of the conflict, and being
Yeah.
able to tell it well. So, okay.
I
Well,
appreciate that.
the documentary is called Louisiana Investors and Innovators. It will have premiered on WYS TV Channel 12 in New Orleans on January 17th, but it's still there. Go to the WYS.org website. It's streamed, and it'll be, I'm sure, reshown many times into the into infinity. So it'll be with us, okay? Dennis, thank you very much.
Thank you, Errol. I appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Louisiana Insider. Subscribe, like, and rate our show where you listen to your podcasts, and follow us on social media at Louisiana Life Mag. Executive producer for Louisiana Insider is Kelly Massico, in cooperation with Louisiana Life Magazine. For subscription information to Louisiana Life, call 504-828-1380. Our theme music was provided by Rich Collins. Hey, that's me. Join us again next week for more discoveries inside Louisiana.